This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the Pentagon was attacked on 9/11, the building burned for 3 days, and the nation's military headquarters almost shut down. 184 people were killed. Surprisingly little has been written about what went on at the Pentagon that day, but it's the focus of a new book called Firefight, Inside the Battle to Save the Pentagon on 9/11. In a moment, we'll meet the authors, journalist Rick Newman and volunteer firefighter Patrick Creed. Creed is also an Army Reserve officer and, in the middle of writing the book, was sent to Iraq where he was injured. First, we're going to hear from someone who was in his office at the Pentagon on 9/11 during the attack. Mark Alasco is a former chief of high-value targeting. After the first phase of the war in Iraq, he left the Pentagon to do human rights work. We heard from him on Fresh Air last month, but we saved this part of the interview for today. Did you think that the Pentagon was going to be targeted?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask that. I was actually in a meeting in the NIMJIC, National Military Joint Intelligence Center, which is this vault inside the Pentagon where the intel guys work. And we were watching the World Trade Center on the TV. And someone said, oh, you know, it's been hit. So there we're watching it. And when the second plane hit, we all looked at each other. And literally, I don't know if I said it or someone I was with said, I bet you we got stingers on the roof of this building now. And we really meant it. I think we really meant it, that there was, you know, there were going to be guys with anti-aircraft missiles all over Washington, D.C., on the White House, on the Pentagon. But I was really still surprised when the boys in black pajamas ran into the office with their submachine guns and screamed, evacuate, we've just been hit. And I was really surprised, even though we had, you know, spoken about that. And, you know, we're in a vault and you're basically underground. And you have to understand the Earth is an incredible insulator. And the Pentagon's a big building. You know, it's a mile from end to end. And I was working on the north side, and the building was hit on the south side. So I didn't feel a damn thing. But as soon as I stepped out of that vault, there were a few things that really struck me. One was the smell. And it was just this smell of burning horsehair, this fire, because the insulation in the Pentagon was horsehair, you know, built back in the 40s. It's the Second World War. You need to use kind of cheap replacement materials. And so they used what was cheap and easy. They used horsehair. And so there's this bizarre burning smell. And the other thing is there's candy all over the place and cans of soda. And it's because all of the candy machines and soda machines had just burst open when the plane hit and the pressure wave went through some of the corridors. And there's glass and debris and this cacophony, and it was just really, really shocking to me that place, which I really and truly believed was probably the safest spot on the place of the earth, was all of a sudden, a target and was on fire.
What was your instinct, to run out or to stay there trying to look for people who might be hurt, to rescue secret documents, information that you needed? Like, what was your instinct?
My first instinct was to call my wife. I immediately picked up the phone, and I called Carolyn, who was working for World Wildlife Fund back in D.C., and I just picked it up. I said, we just got hit. I'm okay. And I got that out, and that was it, and the phones were not working anymore. And once I got out of my area, my first – I was looking to people and just standing there looking around. You know, everyone was a little bit in shock. And I saw a colleague of mine, kind of a mentor, Gary Greco, who is still there working in a fairly senior position in counterterrorism. And I ran up to Gary, who was very senior, and I said, what do we need to do? And he looked at me and he said, Garlasco. He always calls you by your last name, Garlasco. Do you have any medical training? You know any have any medical training at all? I said, no, nothing. And he said, then get the hell out of here. Just go home. And you have to remember, at the time, there was another plane in the air. There were even reports of bombs going off at the State Department and throughout D.C. There was, you know, this chaos. Nobody knew what was happening. And so I thought, okay, you know, let's get the hell out of the building. And I ran out. And as I ran out of the north parking entrance, I you know, was with this huge throng of military and civilian people just funneling out of the building, Because you have to remember, there are thousands of people working in the Pentagon. It's the biggest office building in the world. And I turn around, and there is this huge black cloud just shooting up into the sky. And just, I was numb. It was incredibly numbing. And I was really shocked. Got into the car, started driving down the George Washington Parkway with the local NPR station on. And I heard the first building go down, first World Trade Center, and I did not believe it. I stopped at a light in Old Town Alexandria, and I opened my window and screamed out to the other car across from me. I said, "Did you hear the World Trade Center just collapsed?" And we were having this conversation. I couldn't believe it, and got home. And I mean, you know, I lived very close to the Pentagon, and so I actually got home just in time to see the second tower collapse. And I just sat in my living room, just numb as could be. And I was shaking. I was shaking like a leaf.
Mark Alasco was working at the Pentagon on 9/11. He now works with Human Rights Watch. The new book, Firefight, Inside the Battle to Save the Pentagon on 9/11, tells what happened at the Pentagon that day from the point of view of people who worked there, firefighters and FBI agents. My guests are the authors. Patrick Creed is a volunteer firefighter and amateur historian. He's also an Army Reserve officer who was called to serve in Iraq and was injured there. More on that later. Rick Newman is a staff writer for U.S. News and World Report. Their book will be published next Tuesday. Patrick Creed, Rick Newman, welcome to Fresh Air. Which part of the Pentagon was hit?
The Pentagon, first of all, important to know, is in Arlington, Virginia. It's not in Washington, D.C. It's on the banks, the west bank of the Potomac River. It's on a strip of land between the Potomac River and Arlington Cemetery, Arlington National Cemetery. The plane approached from the west and hit the western side of the building, kind of the southwest. That's kind of a side where there's really no buildings. It's between the cemetery and the Pentagon, and that's where it hit.
The Pentagon is such an odd building. There's more square footage inside the Pentagon than in the Empire State Building, which is, what, about 100 stories tall. It only sits 5 stories above ground, but it occupies an amount of space that's equal to about 2 or 3 city blocks in New York or Chicago. And because of that layout, obviously about 30 to 40% of the building where the plane hit was essentially obliterated, if not by the explosion, then by the fire that burned for about a day and a half afterwards. But on the other side of the Pentagon, people were working in the Pentagon. They didn't even know that a plane had hit the building. They didn't feel anything. And as you kind of walk around the Pentagon to different areas, people who were closer to it felt, you know, some people felt a shudder, as if a freight elevator had sort of come to a hard landing, for instance, in an elevator shaft. But even then, people didn't know what had happened. And when you think about, I mean, we've all seen that video of the second plane hitting the World Trade Center, where you can see the part of the plane actually going, or at least the force of the explosion going out the other side of the building in the skyscraper. It was a totally different scenario at the Pentagon.
What are some of the descriptions that left the biggest impressions on you of what it was like in the building just after the attack?
When I started doing research for the book, I was talking to firefighters at different fire stations in and around Arlington, Virginia, and they continually described it as just absolutely, you could not take a step. There was so much debris, the ceilings, the telephone lines, electrical lines, air conditioning, ducts, all this was hanging down along with just huge piles of debris that they couldn't move a step in the area where the plane had directly impacted. In other areas, the floors were buckled, the walls were buckled, elevators wouldn't open, ceilings had collapsed. And when I first saw the pictures that some of those firefighters had taken, it was striking. You just couldn't imagine. It didn't look that bad from the outside.
There's a real dichotomy between what it looked like from the outside and what was going on the inside. So from the outside, you saw this hole in the building, but it looked like a gash. On the inside, however, one firefighter after another, and also people who were trying to rescue colleagues and so forth, told us that this fire was so hot, they couldn't even get near it. And Pat's a firefighter. He can correct me on the technicalities here. But firefighting gear is can withstand about 500 degrees, I think.
A little more than that.
For short periods of time. And these guys couldn't get at the fire to fight it, because it was 1,500 or 2,000 degrees in some places. And essentially they had to – and this was not their strategy, but they essentially had to let this fire burn itself out.
What about inside – you know, there were so many secret documents inside the Pentagon. Was there a lot of pandemonium as people tried to save things before saving their lives?
For the most part, the people in the worst affected areas, it was instantly obvious that something really terrible had happened. The smoke and the fire was spreading very quickly, and they just needed to get out. And firefighters told us, walking through the building, the water from shattered pipes and from the firefighting efforts, ankle to knee deep in places, secret documents floating around in the water. There wasn't a sense of that. Afterwards, there was a real rush and a real effort to try to get control of these very quickly. The Pentagon security and other elements were trying to get all these safes and secure filing cabinets and recover them, get them out quickly. You know, they couldn't tell which was which. The dials for dialing the combination on these safes had all melted away. Any identifying markings were gone. Many of the users and people who knew which were which were dead and needed to get this stuff out, and they brought it to the north parking lot area and had to figure out how to get it open and what was around and what wasn't. It was kind of chaotic for the people who were obsessed with keeping that stuff secret.
It's really interesting, the different mentality that people had at the Pentagon. Their first reaction was, okay, I have to escape the fire, but first I have to lock up these documents because, you know, national security is at stake. And then when people got outside, one of the surprising things we discovered was that a lot of people who ran out of the building because that's what they were told to do, then tried to get back into the building. And some of them were trying to go back in because they realized that they probably had colleagues who were trapped in there. But some of them were trying to get back in to just secure documents. And there were wrestling matches between firefighters once they finally arrived, who said, you cannot go back into this building. You're just going to make our job harder and we're going to end up having to rescue you. And people who said, I have to get in this building. I left my safe open, or I left the documents sitting out. I have to go get them.
When the military personnel outside started to get the impression or the feeling that the firefighters weren't rescuing people fast enough because they weren't seeing survivors come out, they formed into groups and tried to enter. And we saw with some of the Navy personnel, especially two Navy flight surgeons who we talk about, their first effort was to go and rescue people, crawling through burning areas with no protective gear at all, and made some significant effort, rescued quite a few people who otherwise wouldn't have made it. And it was a mentality of going back in, save the ship. And we saw that throughout. It wasn't just Navy. It was Army and Air Force, where these people formed together in small groups and started to try to rescue people.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the two authors of the new book, Firefight, Inside the Battle to Save the Pentagon on 9/11. Rick Newman is a reporter for U.S. News and World Report. Patrick Creed is an amateur historian, volunteer firefighter, and is a U.S. Army Reserve officer who recently returned from serving in Iraq. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense then, refused to leave the Pentagon. Why did he refuse?
It was his building. He very quickly realized the significance of it. Secretary Rumsfeld, for whatever you think of him, rushed outside and helped carry wounded on stretchers. And then he caught himself and realized that wasn't his job as Secretary of Defense when the country's under attack. He went back into his command area and then refused to leave. He did not leave. He stayed when the place was filling up with smoke, told others they could leave if they wanted to, and he wasn't going anywhere. And, you know, he was the one who announced that the Pentagon would open the next day. And he did not check with fire chiefs before doing that. The fire chiefs were stunned to learn that the building was going to open for business the next day. And they were still fighting the biggest fire of their entire careers. It was raging throughout the building.
Well, in fact, you say some of the firemen didn't even know that Donald Rumsfeld and someone from the Joint Chiefs and other top people had remained in the Pentagon trying to continue to work.
The fire chiefs were pretty surprised to find out that there were still people operating in what's called the National Military Command Center, the NMCC, and an area that's adjacent to it called the Executive Support Center, which is where the defense secretary, that's sort of like his suite of offices for urgent situations, let's say. And somebody from the Joint Staff went running up to the firefighters' command post at one point in the afternoon on 9/11 and said, we've got a problem. We've got smoke. Smoke is coming into the NMCC. What should we do? And the fire chief said, why do you still have people in the NMCC? What are they doing there? And they made an arrangement to get some breathing bottles, oxygen bottles and air masks in there in case they were needed. And at the same time, the building managers were trying to figure out how to work the vents on the roof of the Pentagon to make the smoke go elsewhere.
Describe what Site R is. What the people at the National Military Command Center wanted to do was to start up Site R, where they could locate instead.
Well, I've never been to Site R, so I can't give you a first-person description. It's a classified secret site. It's in the Maryland hills someplace, probably very close to Camp David. Site R is a backup National Military Command Center. So it's designed as a duplicate for the NMCC at the Pentagon. And at least as of 9/11, it was manned by a skeleton staff all the time. But it was a very small crew that basically kept the computers running and stuff like that when Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, or at least when they knew that there was a problem at the Pentagon, they activated Site R. But it took several hours before they could be certain that Site R was completely up and running. And what the military, senior military people and defense people had to do was keep the National Command Authority intact. This is the chain of command that goes from the president or the vice president to the defense secretary or the deputy defense secretary, both civilians, and then to military commanders who would transmit any kind of military orders. So in order for Site R to be fully functioning, there has to be an authorized member of the National Command Authority at Site R. That turned out to be Paul Wolfowitz, who flew there in a helicopter. He was a deputy defense secretary on 9/11.
Against his will, he did not want to go.
He didn't want to go.
He wanted to stay at the Pentagon.
Nobody wanted to leave the Pentagon for obvious reasons. And then they had to make sure they had full connectivity, which means the video teleconferences had to be running. All the communication stuff had to be running. They had to have the ability to transmit orders from Site R. And it was a touch-and-go situation for several hours while the NMCC at the Pentagon was filling with smoke. There were some people who felt they should evacuate. Building managers were telling them they should evacuate. They were measuring carbon monoxide levels in the NMCC. They were going up. The fire chief was explaining to joint staff officers that carbon monoxide poisoning makes people do wacky things. They lose judgment, but they don't know they've lost judgment. And the fire chief said, do you really want people at the inside the Pentagon making decisions under conditions like that? And by mid or late afternoon on 9/11, they did get the full connectivity to Site R. So finally, at that point, the backup facility was up and running for good.
The Pentagon was built to withstand attack, and that special construction actually presented some unique problems for the firefighters. Would you describe what some of those problems were?
The Pentagon initially was actually the impression is that the Pentagon is a fort, but the Pentagon was not actually built as a fort. In fact, when it was built in the early 40s, it was considered to be a temporary military headquarters during World War II that would be turned into a book warehouse or an archive for government documents. And because of that, it was built with floor structures and a physical structure that was heavy for the time, but not fortified. So it was built to the higher end of design standards for the time, but that's only so it could support the weight of a lot of paper. Over the years, they upgraded it, and there were some upgrades actually going on 9/11. It was about a 10-year renovation project, and they had done some things like install blast-resistant windows, which were in place on about half of the area where the impact happened. And those were designed to withstand a bombing like the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. That was really they studied the dynamics of that bombing, and that's how they developed standards for these blast-resistant windows. The Oklahoma City bombing, of course, was a truck bomb that blew up from the outside, so they built these windows at the Pentagon to withstand blasts from the outside. What happened on 9/11 was there was a blast from the outside that became a blast from the inside, so the impact of Flight 77 created multiple explosions from all directions, and some of those, most of them, in fact, were explosions from the inside trying to get out. And the blast-resistant windows did not break. So there were areas within the Pentagon where many people believe these blast-resistant windows absolutely saved lives, because in areas where the explosion could have penetrated further into the building, the blast-resistant windows kept it away. But there were also areas where the blast-resistant windows actually contained the explosion instead of allowing it to vent to the outside, if you will. And it just contained the explosion inside the building, which intensified the effects inside the building.
For firefighters, as a firefighter, when you go into a burning building, one of the things you want to do is try to let the heat vent out of the building. The smoke and the heat get out so you can see what you're doing. You can find victims. You lower the temperature. Firefighters were taking sledgehammers and trying to smash through these blast-resistant windows. Normally would just, you know, they could break with a small tool. We have accounts in the book where they saw firefighters two at a time smashing sledgehammers into windows and being unable to break it. Also where victims were trapped inside and unable to break the windows to escape. The protective material on the outside walls of the building, which was Kevlar, they had Kevlar cloth lining, which is the same thing that's used in bulletproof vests. When the plane tore through the building, it pulled that all throughout the building. And so later when they were trying to recover remains and search the building, you had this cloth material that was almost impossible to cut through, even with power tools, which made it just incredibly difficult for the firefighters to do their job. It just – some of that stuff no one ever anticipated being a problem during an incident like this.
On 9/11, after the Pentagon was attacked by the plane, the roof, part of the roof, was on fire. What the firefighters didn't know until they were told was that if the fire on the roof spread much further, it would basically put the whole Pentagon out of commission. Would you explain what the problem would have been?
On the roof, the initially fire chiefs thought that was a pretty minor problem. There wasn't a significant structural issue. It was sort of separate from the rest of the building. It wasn't going to get down and set offices on fire. They considered it to be a low priority issue, and so they essentially made it a secondary effort. What they found out early the second day was when a military officer approached the fire chiefs and said, "We have a problem. The fire is burning on the roof towards antennas and other critical uplinks so we can communicate around the world. If those uplinks are destroyed, the terrorists have won. We can't communicate. The Pentagon is ineffective." And this was just a complete and total shock. The fire chiefs thought, you know, Chief Plogger, Chief Schwartz from the Arlington County Fire Department thought they had pretty much everything under control. And here you find now we've got to get up on this immense roof, which is very difficult to traverse, and it's on fire. And we have to figure out ways to get ahead of the fire and stop it from spreading to these critical points.
So what were the problems in dealing with the roof? Because there were similar problems that the firefighters had with the blast-proof windows.
They couldn't get the roof fire out. And firefighters are trained for – they're trained to, you know, deal with fires on the top of buildings, and they do all the time on warehouses, on strip malls, things like that. Again, this just gets back to the unusual and really unique way the Pentagon was constructed. So the roof is about a foot thick of concrete with different layers of horsehair insulation, which nobody had ever heard of at the time. They didn't even know that they used to use horsehair as an insulation. And they couldn't get to the fire, so some part of the wooden structure was sort of sandwiched between a foot of concrete on the top and other material underneath it. So they just could not get to this wood that was burning. And you would think, well, how did the fire get there? The fire got there because the jet fuel spewed everywhere. And the jet fuel just got into places where ordinary flames probably wouldn't get. And in some areas, it lit off right away. And in other areas, it just sat there until an ember ignited it or a gust of wind came and ignited it. And they just could not get to this layer of wood that was sandwiched between basically concrete on both sides. And the wood just kept burning, very slowly burning all around the building until it's actually started to circle the building on the inner area, at which point, even if there had not been this sensitive stuff on the roof, the fire could then have gone back down and caught other parts of the building on fire. So it was just a very tricky problem. By the time they realized how serious it was, they put all the firefighters they could get up there and ladder trucks. They actually put porta potties up on top of the roof so they could kind of run this longer range firefighting operation up there than they had ever anticipated.
So how did they get around the problem of the concrete?
Initially, there was power tools brought up, you know, saws to cut through cement, concrete. Most of those broke, and the majority of the labor was done by firefighters taking off their coats and using sledgehammers, axes, to just brute force pound through the concrete. Lots of times they pounded through the concrete. They tried to do something called a trench cut, where like cutting a break in a forest fire so they could catch the fire and stop it before it spread any further. Well, they would get where they thought they were ahead of the fire, pound through the concrete with just incredible effort. And you have to remember, it was a very nice day on September 11th, September 12th, bright, sunny. This was difficult to work in. There's smoke everywhere. They're pounding through the concrete. They get through finally, make a small hole and look through, and the fire's already past that point. It's already beat them, and all that effort was for nothing. They have to grab their tools, run 50 feet further down the roof, and try to get ahead of it again before it spreads past so they can make that break and stop the advance of the fire. This happened, you know, many times. They did get power tools later on, but even after that, the vast majority of the effort was sledgehammers and sweat.
The Pentagon on 9/11 was both a crime scene and the site of a fire that needed to be put out as quickly as possible, and it was the site of a lot of incredibly sensitive top secret documents. So were there conflicts between what the FBI wanted to do to preserve it as a crime scene and to preserve sensitive documents and what the firefighters wanted to do to just kind of get the fire out?
This was a big part of what was fascinating about how they got – how they organized this. And the fire chiefs ended up being the people in charge. And part of that was that these people had all worked together. The Arlington County fire chiefs had worked for years to prepare for the possibility that they might have one of the very important buildings in their county hit. And while they weren't completely prepared, no one ever is, they had done a lot of the groundwork to prepare relationships so that the FBI agents knew the fire chief. They'd worked together. They'd trained together. And they were prepared. And they could do simultaneous evidence collection. There was some madness. You know, one of the fire trucks was parked and an FBI agent asked if they could move it so he could get a piece of evidence underneath the truck. And the firefighter's like, why don't you just crawl underneath? There was a lot of controversy with that.
Terry, you get to the point. These are organizations that are essentially at cross purposes in a situation like this. Firefighters aren't used to delicate work. They are used to bashing into burning buildings and doing whatever they have to do to put out a fire. The FBI, when it collects and preserves evidence, is meticulous, and they want to gather up stuff that is as untouched as they can get it. And this is a situation where you've got fire trucks driving all over the place and literally driving over pieces of the airplane on the western lawn in the Pentagon, plowing through parts of the building just to get to where the fire was. And you literally had FBI agents saying, hey, don't touch that. And we've got firefighters rolling their eyes and FBI agents trying to assert their authority over the scene, and they had to find a way to make it work.
Did they?
The FBI began with this attitude that we have to sort of preserve this scene in pristine shape. So, for instance, they initially tried to collect and catalog every bit of the airplane that they could find. So now they're gathering up literally thousands and thousands of pieces, some tiny bits of aluminum as big as a fingernail. And somebody at the FBI finally said, you know, it's now a day or two later. Okay, we didn't – at the beginning, we didn't really know what happened here. Now we've collected all this other information. We know that this was an airplane that hit the building. We know which airplane it was. We know what kind of airplane it was. Do we really need to gather up every little bit of this airplane? And finally, they went to the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, and said, look, in order to reconstruct the parts that we need to know about, do we need to collect all the parts of the airplane or just certain parts? And the NTSB said, we'll get back to you. And they discussed it and decided you really need the two black boxes, the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder, the famous black boxes. And so at about 2 or 3 days in, the FBI said, okay, we're going to change our procedures. We're going to stop worrying about all these little pieces of the airplane, and we're just going to concentrate our efforts on finding the two black boxes.
Which they found.
They did. They found them about 3 days in, so I think that was on September 14th. The cockpit voice recorder was destroyed. In fact, it was in such bad shape when they found it that the FBI person who dug it out of the rubble actually was about to throw it in a garbage can. And somebody who had a degree in aerospace engineering, who was another FBI agent, said, just hold on a second. Can I see that? And they knew what the black boxes were supposed to look like. A lot of people have probably heard that they're not black. They're orange so that they're findable. But these were very black because they'd been in this fire. And they weren't able to get anything from the cockpit voice recorder. But they were able to salvage the other one, which is the flight data recorder, which tells you the flight path of the airplane, these various parameters of flight altitude and things like that. And they actually did use that to reconstruct with good precision exactly what happened to the airplane in the last 30 minutes of the flight.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the two authors of the new book, Firefight, Inside the Battle to Save the Pentagon on 9/11. Rick Newman is a reporter for U.S. News and World Report. Patrick Creed is an amateur historian, volunteer firefighter, and is a U.S. Army Reserve officer who recently returned from serving in Iraq. Rick, let me read something that you've written. You wrote, "Ground Zero may still be sacred ground, but the Pentagon was treated as a battlefield where the military remove their dead, commemorate them, and prepare for the next battle."
There was clearly a battlefield mentality among the military people at the Pentagon, and I would say that even transferred somewhat to the firefighters. There was some conflict between soldiers trying to get back into the building and firefighters trying to keep them out. And we talked to many firefighters who said they actually hated doing that because they could see that what these soldiers were doing was basically responding as if they were in war and as if they were in combat, which is what they're trained for. And the Defense Department insisted on taking out its own dead from the building. They had members of the Old Guard, which is the Army's ceremonial unit, carried out every set of remains, even if they weren't the ones who actually did the documentation and the recovery. They would formally carry out each set. And it was all done with great dignity, in a very military way, with extreme care to do it away from TV cameras too. They actually did some things to block the view of cameras that were set up on the hillside overlooking the Pentagon, just to do this with the proper formality.
Give us a sense of what was lost at the Pentagon on 9/11, both in terms of the number of people who died and also the documents and other secrets that were lost.
In terms of human loss, there were 64 people on board the plane, of course, all who died, 59 passengers and crew plus the five terrorists. 124 people died at the scene. One person died in hospital. In terms of documents and building space, I haven't heard anyone lament that they lost all the copies of their budget. The human toll and the emotional toll was significantly greater than anything in terms of planning. We talked to a lot of people who had, for instance, all their budgeting data for the next 5 years destroyed and burned up. Nobody really talks about that much. No one I interviewed talked about that they lost a cool painting on their wall or that all their data and all their emails had been wiped out. It really focused on the human toll and the emotional toll of that feeling of vulnerability. The most important building in the Department of Defense had a plane slam into it going 500 miles an hour, and it was able to do that, and it gave that sense of vulnerability. You see that now in how the Pentagon and all the Department of Defense buildings, they've changed a tremendous amount about the inside of the buildings, how they're laid out, the safety precautions, evacuation precautions to prevent a lot of the things that went wrong on 9/11.
What are some of those changes?
For instance, all the furniture that was in the Pentagon as part of the renovation was modular furniture, like you see like a cubicle farm. When you go to any large office space, you see all the cubicles lined up. That's also how people figure out where the exits are. You walk down this line of cubicles, you get to someone's desk, and you turn left, and that takes you to the exit. When the plane came through, it came through like a hurricane or a tidal wave of flame. It knocked all that down, set it on fire. We know of several people who, crawling towards exits, weren't able to find their way out and died. They were part of a group, and they got lost in the smoke and weren't able to find their way out. Since then, the Pentagon, if you go to it, has glow tape along the wall with arrows along the tape pointing to the exits. When you get to a door, if it's not an exit, it's got red X and glow tape across it. People in the building have escape hoods, like you used to see in magazines and Air Mall and the airplanes, catalogs for sale. They have those now so they can put it on and make it out through the smoke.
And the windows have been changed too.
Right. Every so often in the windows, there's an etched firefighter's helmet so that with levers so that window can be removed even though it's bomb resistant so people can escape and firefighters can do their job as well. Those were all things that weren't in place. If you're crawling on the floor and the exit signs are lower because smoke and heat rise, people couldn't see the exit signs up above. There's been a lot of changes like that done because they realized that it just wasn't as safe as it could have been. And the newer areas have all seen those. And if you go to the Pentagon now, they on a tour even, you can see those and they explain those as you walk through.
You know, there are so many horrible things that you describe at the Pentagon on September 11th. But it's funny, one of the things that so many people comment about is that horsehair insulation. This was installation that was used in the 1940s when the Pentagon was built. And we heard Mark Alarsko at the beginning of the show talk about the horrible smell it produced. Many people who you interview comment on how horrible the smell of the burning horsehair was. Can you talk a little bit about why that made such an impression on everybody?
It's a unique smell. You don't smell burning horsehair in your daily routine. That and many people also, the smell of jet fuel. The jet fuel was everywhere. And when the water started to hit the fire, water was flowing everywhere. It carried fuel all throughout the building. And so that was another smell that people have come to overwhelmingly associate with the Pentagon and their experiences there. Smell is one of those triggers. You can smell something and it brings you instantly back to your childhood. It's one of those psychological triggers that in your mind sticks out a little bit more than other senses.
Patrick, you were the person who initiated this book. You started the research, and then, Rick, you came on the project, and the two of you collaborated on the book. While doing the book, Patrick, you were called up to go to Iraq. You were a member of the reserves, the individual ready reserve. So you were called up and basically given 30 days and told that you'd have to report.
I got a letter October 17th, 2005, and it said, be at Fort Jackson on November 15th, 2005, and be prepared for about 500 days of active duty service, and you're going to Iraq.
Did you think you were going to be called up?
I suspected it. It was, you could see at that point that the war was suddenly going a lot longer than anyone anticipated, and it was not a surprise. It was a shock, but it was not a surprise. It was, especially since I had only known Rick for about a month. He had just signed the book deal that, finally someone's going to let me write this book and we're going to get to publish it and it's going to be about the story I've been working on for all these years. And then right when we have success, hey, guess what? You're going to Iraq.
This is going to sound like a very insensitive question, but Rick, how did you feel you just signed on to this project and your partner on the project is going to Iraq where, I hate to put it in such crass terms, but, who knew if he'd survive the tour?
Well, those crass terms are the same terms I used to think this through. I knew Pat was going to be going when we agreed to do this project together. And we figured, we'll have email. Pat said, I have instant messaging. We'll be able to keep in touch. And I thought, it's just a, it's a one-year window. Just deal with the 1 year out and back. And then we'll just pick up. I'll do what I can while he's gone. And it didn't work that way, not surprisingly. Pat was in a very difficult part of Iraq. Pat got injured in a roadside bombing, came home for a little while for medical treatment. I sort of made the mistake of thinking, oh, great, I've got my partner back. He's okay. Then Pat returned to Iraq. And when he finally came home for good, which was May of last year, I thought again, oh, great, I've got my partner back. But Pat was very busy going to funerals. And, we've talked about the experience, he was a returning combat vet, and we did not just pick up where we left off.
Patrick, what was your injury?
I suffered a traumatic brain injury. I had a series of roadside bombs and that gave me concussions, blasts very close to the vehicle, and finally had one final one in August 2006 that knocked me unconscious and gave me the TBI, traumatic brain injury, and created a lot of problems. It was very difficult and was working with some significant side effects with PTSD of working in – I was in Diyala province near the city of Bakuba. It was not a nice place. There was a lot of really bad things that happened. And, I highly recommend that if you're ever going to write a book, don't try to do it from Iraq. And if you have to, then you better have a partner as good as Rick. Rick's calming influence in – calling and emailing home and having the distraction of writing chapters. I told Rick, one day I was getting up to go on a patrol and I was sick to my stomach. I was terrified to get in the vehicle. We'd been almost blown up the day before and here we are going out again. And it's just kind of maddening to think of, but I did have chapter 17 under my arm. I was taking it with me so that if there was a gap, I could do it. And I remember looking and I was like, this is madness. But I did take it. And in the course of a meeting that day where the Iraqis were all chattering away in Arabic with each other at a local town, I was editing chapter 17 with a red pen, waiting for the interpreter to tell me what they were saying.
Did you do a good job? editing it under those circumstances?
it was very hard because you came back from, you know, it was 120 degrees outside. You're wearing all this equipment. You're getting shot at, or just even just a day where you weren't getting shot at. It was just a long day out on the road or talking with people, dealing with stress. You come back, try to communicate with my son at home and my wife, former wife, and trying to deal with all that stress. And then there's six emails from Rick about the book, and you have to dig into those and print out the chapters and try to dig through that. And Rick's like, well, we need more information. Can you call this guy? Well, okay. Well, I got to walk to the other side of our small base and get on the satellite phone and call some firefighter and try to ask him, you know, can you tell us which entrance you went through again? We can't remember. We're trying to get it right. And it was crazy, but, you know, that's kind of how it worked out.
I thought it would be healthy for Pat to have a few petty distractions while he was in the midst of a war zone. Yeah.
Pat, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think traumatic brain injury is a new injury unique to the war in Iraq, suffered by people who have concussive injuries from being near the explosion, not from being hit directly, but from the reverberations of the explosion. And doctors are still trying to figure out how to deal with it. I think there's a lot of questions about medical compensation for it. What have your symptoms been?
There's been a few funny ones that were kind of a surprise. I used to have an amazing recollection for remembering people who I'd worked with from years and years before in the Army, went to basic training. You walk by me on the street, I'd say, hey, I remember you. Now I have a funny thing that's called facial blindness. I can't remember what people look like. If the editor from Random House walked in the room right now, I wouldn't know it was her. And some people stick, some people don't, but the vast majority of the people I meet, I'm not going to be able to remember who they were or what they looked like. I can remember their names, that I talked to them, the situation, but it's kind of like everyone's wearing one of those pantyhose ski masks over their faces, and I can't remember them. It's tough. I don't like going to shopping malls anymore because people walk up to me and say hi, and I don't know who they are. And if it's a controlled situation, you know, you're going to someone's house or a school board meeting, it's a little bit easier to piece together who people are, but have some trouble with reading. It's very hard for me to follow words down a page. It's got an eye tracking thing that the doctors at the VA are working have been very helpful. I've had a very good experience with the Veterans Administration. Very helpful. They've done everything they can. Their biggest complication is me, and I can, you know, try to make it to schedules and make it to appointments and all of that. But the armor in our truck saved us. We had the upgraded armored trucks by the time I was in Iraq, and a blast that would have probably destroyed most other vehicles in the world in previous wars, we survived. And it was just a tremendous amount of concussion and pressure that rolled over and through us. And it was pretty devastating at the time. I still see that. I can remember those blasts, even the big brown flash before I lost consciousness on the last one.
So it was after you got the traumatic brain injury that you came home to recuperate and then were sent back to Iraq?
I came home with my injury, and I kept thinking I was going to return. The doctors were undecided about whether or not I was hurt bad enough that I could go back. I wanted to go back. My soldiers were there. My friends were there. I felt terrible being at home while they were still in combat. There were two majors in my unit. One was the commander. I was the other one. He was wounded after me, and so the unit was essentially leaderless. They sent one major to replace the both of us. He was killed 4 days on the job, Major Alan Johnson. That was devastating to me. I went to his funeral at Arlington while I was still home. I volunteered to go back and received a medical override to go back and essentially bring the unit home. I wanted to go and be with them and bring them back. And that was the reason I was against the medical advice. And they gave me all kinds of preconditions. I wasn't supposed to go on missions. I wasn't supposed to go on convoys. When I got back, I ignored all those, of course. But I went back to try to bring my guys home. It was very hard being home and knowing that all the people who I trained with and worked with were still there.
Are you still fighting fires?
Yes. I'm a member of the local volunteer fire department in Havertown, Pennsylvania, Bonnier Fire Department. I live across the street from the firehouse.
Uh-huh. Just one more thing. You know, here you are. You're writing this book on the Pentagon on 9/11. The Bush administration makes this connection between the 9/11 attacks and Iraq, starts a war in Iraq. You end up fighting in that war. By the time you were called up to go to Iraq in 2005, a lot of the evidence that the Bush administration had presented to support invading Iraq had been disproven. So how did you feel, you know, writing this book about September 11th, being sent to Iraq after a lot of the supporting evidence had been kind of thrown out?
Well, to make it as simple as I can, and you know, as a firefighter, it's a lot like being a soldier. You don't really worry too much at the time about how the fire started. Your job is to put it out. And being a soldier, my job was to go over and do everything I could to improve the situation as best I could. And I did that. Obviously, there's been proven that there's no connection between 9/11 attacks in Iraq. They weren't involved. But that didn't influence it. There's not a lot of soldiers who sit around and kind of dwell on the philosophical aspects of the war. Your immediate goal, like a firefighter, your goal is to put the fire out and not burn to death in the process. And as a soldier, my job was to do everything I could to complete the mission, keep my soldiers alive, and not get killed in the process.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you and be well.
Thanks for your interest, Terry.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Patrick Reed and Rick Newman are the authors of Firefight, Inside the Battle to Save the Pentagon on 9/11. Creed is an Army Reserve officer, volunteer firefighter, and amateur historian. Newman is a staff writer for U.S. News and World Report. Firefight will be published next Tuesday. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.